Mark Kermode, good afternoon.
Do you know why theremins are called theremins, then?
Theremins.
You know what a theremin is, incidentally? Theremins is in all those old classic science fiction movies, and more recently in Mars Attacks, it's the machine which goes...
Oh, right, this is like a musical instrument.
Exactly, it's a musical instrument. Yes, it's an aerial, you move your hand backwards and forwards. Jimmy Page made some very terrible noise with it. But you know why it's called a theremin? Have a guess. The most obvious answer. It's invented by...
Roger Theremin.
Roger Theremin, yeah. I mean, not Roger, but yes, Mr. Theremin.
Brian Theremin.
Brian Theremin, yes.
Good. Well, that was an entertaining piece of radio. When people download that via the website, I'm sure that'll be something that they treasure for a very long time. And, by the way, the James Boland play, when James Boland was here, someone had asked him about a radio play that he'd done for Radio 4 in which he was sort of playing an unborn child, and he couldn't remember it. I'm indebted, as they say, to William Whiteside, who's the arts desk person at The Independent, who says the play was Getting Out, and it was in 1979. It was written by Michael Bartlett.
You have to be impressed that somebody other than James Boland remembered him playing an unborn child, but not him.
James Boland had no idea. Well, he did vaguely remember, and he thought Ian Holm was involved in it somewhere. However, okay. The play was Getting Out by Michael Bartlett. I hope that sorts that one out. So, lots of emails already about Batman, which we'll get to fairly shortly. Batman Begins being one of the movies. Bonbon and Perrault is one. 13 Conversations About One Thing. Undertow. And We Don't Live Here Anymore. UK box office top 10, first of all, at 10, Kingdom of Heaven.
I think this is probably the last week it's going to be in the chart. So the
it's been around a long time, actually.
It has, and I'm glad to see it has. So it's the last time I'm going to say it. Obviously flawed, obviously all over the place, obviously Orlando Bloom can't carry the movie. But on the other hand, still worth seeing, and good to see that people have seen it.
Paranita at 9.
Sort of, you know, not overly remarkable, but perfectly nice, likeable period Bollywood movie. Fine, sort of old-fashioned.
Millions at 8.
I like it very much. And, you know, again, the advertising campaign is the Danny Boyle movie that you can take your kids to see. I would say it's the older end of the kids market, but it's great. And I guarantee you that if you do take sort of 10, 11, 12-year-old kids to see it, they will remember it. I mean, they will come away from it with stuff to talk about, particularly the Invocation of Saints stuff, which is very weird.
The League of Gentlemen Apocalypse, this week's number 7.
I didn't like it. I mean, I thought it was... It's designed very heavily, and it's attempting to do that kind of weird, offbeat, wacky Wicker Man stuff. But all it convinced me of, and as you know, I'm not a devotee of the television series. I'd only ever seen one episode of the television series, and it looked to me like that standard thing. You take a 30-minute... I imagine the TV series was 30 minutes, and you expand it to 90 minutes. And even if you do a great, inventive, self-reflexive plot, this case, the characters attempting to find the people who made them so that they don't get written out of their own story. You have half an hour and you think, that's it, you've done all the jokes and I've had enough.
Monster-in-Law, this week's number 6.
Your friend Jane Fonda. A strange thing to have come out of retirement for this. I mean, when you consider the extraordinary things that Jane Fonda has done with her life, it seems extraordinary having to say, yeah, well, I'll go back to acting to go opposite Jennifer Lopez and I'll play the Monster-in-Law from Hell. A couple of laughs, but it's pretty bad.
I think she's actually said about, it was a good financial thing and she needs to raise some money for one of her foundations or
something.
Well,
fine. In that case, I'm glad that some good came of it.
House of Wax at number 5.
Not terrible. And certainly, I think the best of the Dark Castle rehashes. You do get to see, what's her name, Paris Hilton, get hideously dealt with, which is no bad thing. And the end set piece is quite good, but obviously it's not a patch on the either on the 30s original, or, and this is the last time I'm going to do this, or the 1953 remake by André de Toth, who famously...
Had mumps. One eye.
Very good.
Pacifier at 4.
I just, Vin Diesel, he changes nappies and goes, ugh. It's the same movie as Kindergarten Cop, but without the charismatic charm of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and believe me, I do not say that lightly.
Sin City at 3.
Designed within an inch of its life, a real step forward in terms of comic book adaptations on screen. Some people have complained about its amoral. It's not amoral. It is amoral. It's a comic book adaptation. Don't take it seriously. It's not really about real people and real violence. It's a comic strip, and it does that brilliantly. It is, however, half an hour too long.
Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith at number 2.
And we've covered this in some detail.
We have. And at number 1, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. That's a hit.
It opened at number 1. It'll be interesting to see if it has any legs, and I suspect that it won't at all. I didn't hate it as much as some people do. I know that an awful lot of people wrote in last week saying they saw it and they really hated it. I counted 7 laughs. All of them were Vince Vaughn. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie just pout and preen, and I don't like them particularly. But It's rubbish, but it's a seven laugh rubbish film. That's not enough to get you through. And in fact, incidentally, I got a taxi the other day and I got into this taxi and the guy was very nice, but he then tore me off a strip for being too nice to Mr. and Mrs. Smith because he had been taken by his wife. And you said it was all right. I said, I didn't say it was all right. I said it was seven laughs and they were all Vince Vaughn.
Seven's all right.
Yeah, it's all right. It's, you know, they're spaced out because it's a 2 hour movie.
The theremin, by the way,
yes.
As you know, was actually invented by Lev Terman, who then changed his name to Leon Theremin. And then he went to the States in the 1920s.
Yeah, but he was called Theremin at the point that he invented the theremin. There is also, of course, another version.
Otherwise, it would have been called the Terman.
Another version of the theremin as well, which is something called the electric theremin, which is the thing that you play with your finger pressing along a stylophone board. And that was pioneered by somebody else whose name...
Rolf Harris.
No, not Rolf Harris. Rolf Harris was the stylophone, him and David Bowie, who plays the stylophone on the solo on Space Oddity.
So, the big movie of the week, one would imagine, is as far as the budget is concerned,
yes,
and the promotion budget, seems to be Christian Bale's appearance as Batman.
Well, the budget looks like it's around the $140 million mark, which is fairly astonishing. Most sort of blockbusters will now cost upwards of $100 million, but $140 million is fairly big. Both that and War of the Worlds are in that kind of area. So, a huge amount of money being spent... If you're a follower of the Batman Scream franchise, you will know that Joel Schumacher effectively killed it stone dead because he had the one episode with Val Kilmer. Started off with Tim Burton. Tim Burton said, I'm going to do everything very gothic, very dark, going to refer to Frank Miller and all that sort of stuff, and then made Batman and Batman Returns, both of which I thought were actually fairly dull. I never really understood why those movies weren't as good as they were. Then along came Joel Schumacher. He did one episode with Val Kilmer, which was quite good fun, largely because the film consisted entirely of the shots of people's bottoms clad in rubber. I mean, it was just this incredibly sort of fetishistic movie in which people clipped things on and click things an awful lot, and Val Kilmer said that line about it must be the car, chicks love the car. But Val Kilmer was his usual terrible self,
which was the he's my new friend because he was in the other day.
Well,
which was the George Clooney one then?
That was the one afterwards, which was Batman and Robin, which was the one which effectively sank the franchise. It was the one in which Arnold Schwarzenegger said, you know, oh, I'm Mr. Freeze,
oh,
and you
one.
Won't put the cool on, and it was kicked around town by absolutely everybody. In fact, I have to say, I didn't hate it as much as anybody else because I thought it was just pantomime nonsense, but it was really, really reviled. So then the franchise kind of went into death throes and stopped. Now revised, Christopher Nolan at the helm. Christopher Nolan, proper director, made films like Memento and the remake of Insomnia. So he's a proper, intelligent, smart director. Batman Begins obviously goes right back to the origins, effectively wipes the slate clean, doesn't attempt to map onto the Burton versions or the Schumacher versions, takes the story of Batman, of young Bruce Wayne, kind of rewrites it, rewrites the traumas of this young man brought up in incredible wealth, loses his parents because they're killed in a mugging in Gotham City, and therefore falls into the criminal underworld in order to discover how the criminal mind works, goes off and has a bit of Zen training at the hands of Liam Neeson, who reappears later on in the movie in a sort of strange twist of the narrative, and then comes back to Gotham City, meets top crime boss, played by your very new friend, Tom Wilkinson, who was in recently. And is absolutely great. Anyway, it's much darker, it's much grittier, it's much tougher, it's much more realistic, and it is frankly much better than any of the Batman movies so far. Find me another moment in any of the previous Batman movies in which somebody could have actually delivered that soliloquy, quite apart from the fact that he is really good, and he does a very sort of menacing...
Tom Wilkinson.
Find another area in one of the previous Batman movies in which you could have got away with doing that. The things that are great about Batman Begins, firstly, it's basically a little independent, weird art movie trapped within the body of a $140 million blockbuster. So what we get is, we get an hour of character development, but really interesting character development. Character development taking place against spectacular backdrops, but character development nonetheless.
So this is before he actually puts on any black leather at all?
Yeah, exactly. And all the stuff before Batman actually begins. You have the stuff about Bruce Wayne and the terrible guilt that he feels about the loss of his parents, the weird process that he goes through in descending into the criminal underworld. When we meet him, he's in prison, him then learning his martial arts skills at the hand of Liam Neeson, who again is a kind of Nietzschean character. On the one hand, you think he's very good, but in fact his good is very close to evil. By the time Bruce Wayne gets back to Gotham and has these conversations with these top-ranking criminals, he realizes that in fact the police and the criminals and the justice system are all very, very close together. Now, this is an idea which has long been embodied in the Batman comics, but has strangely been missing from the movies, because the movies have always attempted to play, I think, to a much more general audience. There is half an hour of stuff blowing up. There is half an hour of huge rocket-powered action, which, for my money, is the stuff that Christopher Nolan says, look, I've done the work, now I have to have the stuff to sell the movie. And it's interesting that when you see the trailer, it leans very heavily on the spectacle and obviously on the design. However, whereas Batman movies in the past have referred to films like Fritz Lang's Metropolis or Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, this is now very commonplace. I cannot remember a Batman movie that had a sequence that specifically referred to George Romero's Day of the Dead, and that was really impressive for me. There are moments of very sort of full-blooded horror. It's a 12A certificate. The BBFC keeps saying this. 12A certificate means 12-year-old, or if you think there's a very special circumstance, take somebody maybe younger. We are not talking about a young person's movie for two reasons. Firstly, because there is scary stuff in it. Cillian Murphy, the actor who I first saw in Disco Pigs, which I hated, and then he was in 28 Days Later, the Danny Boyle zombie movie. He plays a really, really creepy psychotherapist, psychiatrist, nutball character in this film, and he's really nasty and really edgy and really tough. But there's scary stuff in it, but there's also a good hour of stuff which younger audiences, I think, simply won't get a handle on. For all the stuff that George Lucas talked about saying Star Wars 3, this is the dark one, this is the one that really does the business. No, it doesn't. Obviously, Star Wars 3 is a total load of old rubbish. There's no darkness in it at all. Anakin Skywalker gets a bit grumpy one day and goes, ooh, I think I might as well go over to the dark side. In this, we actually have something that approaches profound psychological development. Now, that said, of course it's a Batman movie. So, of course, there is the Batmobile. But the Batmobile is actually
It's a tank.
Well, it's a tank, exactly.
Tank.
It kind of makes sense, because what it is a military vehicle that's been developed by Wayne Enterprises and has therefore, you know, been developed for a purpose other than for Michael Keaton or Val Kilmer to jump into so it looks sleek when he's running around Gotham City. There is a fantastic supporting cast, which includes people like Rutger Hauer. Would that we could see more of Rutger Hauer, because I really like him. Gary Oldman, who gets to deliver one of the best speeches in the movie when he starts talking to Batman. In the middle of all this stuff, in the middle of all this chaos, he has this brilliant speech in which he says, all this is a war of escalation. We get semi-automatics, they get automatics. It's all going to hell in a handcart. And it's dealing with this very dark, very tough, very nihilistic stuff. Christian Bale is great. And Christian Bale, if you've seen American Psycho, there's an awful lot of comparison between what he does in American Psycho and what he does in Batman. He basically plays Batman in the way I think that Frank Miller reimagined Batman, as a psycho head case. It's too long, and the last half hour, which I think is there to sell the movie to the popcorn crowd, does get a little bit grating. But generally, it is every bit as good as you could possibly expect from a $140 million movie, and is by quite some distance the best Batman movie, and absolutely puts Star Wars back down in the ground where it belongs.
Owen says, saw Batman Begins last night and loved it. Christopher Nolan is a genius. The cast is superb. Hope George Clooney and Joel Schumacher watch it and weep.
I'm sure they will, because Joel Schumacher apparently said to Woody Allen, having made Batman and Robin, he said, it's terrible, I've made the worst movie of all time. And Woody Allen apparently replied, no, you haven't. That would have been an achievement. You haven't even done that.
Nick in Leeds. Batman Begins is brilliant. Christopher Nolan has dug the franchise out of the grave it was sent to thanks to Joel Schumacher's Forever and Robin. All that happens in those two films is just two major stars wearing stupid costumes and looking very silly.
Yes.
John in Cardiff. I need your help, Mark. My girlfriend has no interest in seeing Batman Begins. The original Burton movie she enjoyed mainly due to Keaton, Nicholson, Bassinger and Burton's direction, but Begins the only draw for her is Gary Oldman and slightly Morgan Freeman. Please give me a few one-liners that will convince her that Batman Begins must be seen and tonight, otherwise I'll be sneaking out on the weekend.
Okay, I think that that Christian Bale is a big draw, and interestingly enough, I was on the phone to the press officer from the British Board of Film Classification just before it came on. It's a very, very smart woman called Sue Clark, and I said, oh, I just saw Batman, did you see it? She said, yes, I saw it, and she liked it very much as well, and we had a little bit of a discussion about whether or not it plays to men as well as women, and we both agreed that it's completely universal, whereas I think the other movies were rather boysy.
John in Cardiff, I think that's part of your license fee rebate there. You talk about theremin,
yes.
theremins. Earlier. How much do you think it would cost? And thank you to the people from Theremin World for all the info. How much do you, if you wanted an Etherwave theremin, how much do you think it would set you back?
$700-800?
$3,000.
Oh, well.
If you want to, of course, make the opening sound for Good Vibrations, that was a...
Funnily enough, it wasn't. It was an electric theremin in which you play on a flat piece of steel rather than on the point, rather than the thing that you point at. The name of the guy who played it on Good Vibrations is the name of the guy that I was trying to remember.
This is from Terry in Portsmouth, taking my son and mates to watch Batman for a 10th birthday tomorrow.
Okay.
Is that good or not?
Yeah, I figure, I mean, if they are, 10-year-olds, I think, can just about manage it. If they go, there are some scary things in it, and I would say the biggest difficulty difficulty is that they have to have a big attention span, because there are long sections of, you know, of character dialogue all happening in beautiful settings, but it's quite dark and there's a long way before he gets to being Batman. But if they are advanced 10-year-olds, fine, make sure they're well supervised.
The first Spider-Man was a 12A. Mm-hmm. It was the first 12A yes. that actually turned up. Is it on a par with that?
I mean, it's darker. Yeah. Okay. So the first Spider-Man was 12A because there's a lot of kind of violence in it, but this is darker in theme and tone.
Elsa in Manchester, was Batman on audition for James Bond, do you think, for Christian Bale?
No, he'd never play James Bond. I think he'd be completely the wrong person.
John says, saw Batman Begins last night. One question has been bothering me since. Whose idea was it to make Christian Bale talk like a wrestler as soon as he puts his costume on?
But it is true that whenever he puts the mask on, suddenly his voice goes down like that. But that's fine, it's Batman, you know.
Batman Begins, then, is the big box office release. What else is out?
Okay, we don't live here anymore. Now, one of the things you want to watch out for whenever you watch a movie is that when the credits come up, if actors have their names in the production credits, it's very bad, okay? Alfred Hitchcock once famously said, I never said actors are cattle. I said they should be treated as cattle. And Hitchcock was perfectly right. As soon as you allow actors to start making decisions for themselves, things start to go pear-shaped. We Don't Live Here Anymore is one of those classic movies that are made by actors who get together and decide that they're doing an actor's piece. They've got a script that's about these two warring couples, two men, two women. They're all sleeping with each other and they're all lying to each other and they're all incestuously bitching about each other. Remember when I reviewed a few months ago Closer, the Patrick Marber play, and I said I'm never before have I come across a more hateful set of people, and I would do gouge my eyes out rather than be in the same room as them. Well, on the basis of We Don't Live Here Anymore, come into my sitting room, the entire cast of Closer, come and enjoy tea and crumpets and afternoon, because anything rather than these people, okay? Mark Ruffalo, producer Mark Ruffalo, executive producer Mark Ruffalo, and Laura Dern are talking about the problematic relationship that they have with the other couple, played by Peter Krause, and producer Naomi Watts. And this is pretty much the whinging tone of the whole film. And so it goes on for the best part of 2 hours. 15 minutes in, I had my head between my knees thinking, all of you, go away! Go and do the thing you are threatening to do, but don't do it in my cinema because I have a life to be getting on with. I actually started to hyperventilate. I started gripping the edge of the chairs because I thought, I'm going to do that thing that I did in Cannes. I'm going to get up and I'm going to start shouting at the screen. There's one moment when the camera... No, I didn't. I was really containing myself. I mean, I was literally thinking, I have to drink less caffeine. I have to, you know, I have to stop taking sugar, because if I react like this to this, he's going to give me a heart attack. There was a moment when the camera went across a desk and on it was a pair of scissors. And I thought, pick this pair of scissors up, and somebody's going, no, it doesn't happen. The pair of scissors stays there. They carry on whinging. There's another moment when Mark Ruffalo is standing by a rock and you think, it's okay, he's going to throw himself into the ring. It's all going to be over. He doesn't. He just carries on standing by a rock. And then there's this great moment when the door bursts open and somebody comes in with a chainsaw but then I realised, no, I'd fallen asleep and I'd woken up. I just had this wish fulfillment dream that somebody would do something in this horrible, self-obsessed, narcissistic, preening, grisly travesty of a movie, and they just keep talking, and they've got these perfect houses and these perfect lives and these perfect, they just keep whinging and moaning, and one of them, oh, two of them are teachers, but the teachers don't appear to do anything, like they're college lecturers, but they just appear to sit around crabbing about how awful their life is. And I'm thinking, okay, I hate the people, I hate the writing, I hate the subject, I hate the direction, I hate everything about this film. And then of course you look at the press notes and you go, fine, the actors produced it themselves, the actors are the people behind it, and this is what happens. Hitchcock was right. Hitchcock was absolutely right. Actors act. They do not make creative decisions. And on the basis of this, I would say you should outlaw any movie which has two actors and a screenwriter credited amongst the production credits. What you need is William Castle or, you know, Roger Corman standing over you with a big stick saying, I'm sorry, if you don't do something exciting in the next 30 seconds, you're fired.
This or Lord of the Revenge of the Sith, what would you rather?
Revenge of the Sith. I mean, at least Revenge of the Sith.
That's fine.
You know,
you've put it in context.
I don't wish to overstate this, but I honestly thought that I was going to have some kind of. I mean, I started to worry about myself. You know, people always write in and say I get. I thought.
Breathe through your ears.
Yes.
Like ancient Greek ghosts.
It was just horrible.
Okay, so we'll be back with more fine reviews. And if you want to hear any of all this again, don't forget you can download it for fun. Imagine listening to that every day. And for late arrivals, Mark, if we just had to summarise the whole thing. So We Don't Live Here Anymore.
It's just hideous. I mean, literally, gnaw your hand off rather than endure it. And there's a lovely quote on the poster.
It's just for late arrivals.
For Entertainment Weekly, which says, the acting will leave you breathless. I mean, breathless. It virtually left me expire. I mean, I could not breathe.
Pete Holman says, if Mark was sitting in a cinema with his head between his knees and hyperventilating, what on earth was he doing? Anyway,
no, sadly, it's a kind of regular thing.
Kwame and Finchley says, what a wonderful rant that was from Mark. I look forward to several more as popcorn no-brainer blockbuster season continues.
But I like the popcorn no-brainer blockbuster more than that.
Nawaz Nazir says, could you ask Mark which film is worse, the one he's just reviewed or Sex Lives of the Potato Men?
You know, that's a really good question and a really tough call. I think they're equally hateful. You'd have to say that Sex Lives of the Potato Men was worse, in as much as Sex Lives of the Potato Men is just so foul that afterwards you feel like you need to bath in Clorox. Whereas with this, you just want to punch people.
What happens in Clorox?
You know, Clorox, you know, bleach. Bath in Clorox.
Mark in Leicester, as much as I value Mark's learned advice, I hope this condemnation of actor-directors does not include Zach Braff, the actor-director of Garden State and Scrubs, which are my favourite film and sitcom respectively. Braff is a visionary, and I hope Mark doesn't include him in his category of useless actor-director. Or have I got the wrong end of the stick?
Well,
Danny DeVito as well, we could check.
Well, I think, you know, obviously, there are, and of course, Leonardo DiCaprio, the best thing he ever did was something that he had produced himself, which was The Aviator. So I think there are exceptions, but I think, as a general rule, Hitchcock was right. And it's a point that David Thompson picks up in his book, The Whole Equation, The History of Hollywood. He says that basically the point at which studios stopped treating actors as contract players and started asking the actors what it was that they wanted, in general, art did not take a huge, giant leap forward.
So we've had Batman Begins and We Don't Live Here Anymore. Undertow is the new Jamie Bell movie.
So you had Jamie Bell on the programme.
Yes, we did.
And he was a very nice chap.
He was very nice.
And this is the latest movie by David Gordon Green, who had a couple of hits, well, independent hits, with George Washington and All the Real Girls. It's a story set in the Deep South. Of course, if you know anything about Jamie Bell, you'll know that he's not from the American Deep South. He's, of course,
the Deep Northeast.
The Deep Northeast. And he does a very good job of the accent. Apparently, at the beginning of the film, it says this was made with the help of law enforcement officers from Georgia and also of the family. And so it implies that it's a true story, but in fact it's much closer to a parable. The inspiration for the story was apparently told, there's a runaway hotline, and somebody rang up and told one of the runaway hotline call monitorers this story, which then turned out to be sort of fictional. But what happened was David Gordon Green thought it was an interesting story and made it into a movie that looks like it ought to be real, but in fact is much more based on mythology and a parable. The story is that there is a father and his brood, one of whom is played by Jamie Bell with a lovely accent. The father's brother returns from out of prison. It's very Cain and Abel, and there is some Mexican gold coins which one of the brothers has, which the other brother wants, which then get into the hands of the offspring, and then it becomes a chase movie. So it's very much, there's conversations about trips across the River Styx, there's stuff about eternal damnation, souls. I mean, I love all this. Very, very early on, somebody gets their foot nailed to a piece of wood.
Yeah, so we mentioned that when Jamie was on, because obviously
exactly.
He's not going to do any more dancing at all.
It's wince-tastic, that moment, isn't
it? But he actually did it.
Yes. Yeah,
apparently there is a scene earlier on in the movie, which didn't actually make it, but he actually does put a nail through his foot in the course of filming whole project.
Well, I did go, generally, the sort of the lilting tone of the piece. You've seen it, right?
Yep.
It's visually very beautiful. I could have done without the jump cuts. I could have done without the freeze frames. That I don't find entirely necessary. But David Gordon Green has got a very good eye for this particular location. Interestingly enough, one of the executive producers on it is Terrence Malick. Now, of course, Terrence Malick is best known for Badlands and for capturing a certain kind of Southern Gothic. And I think that there is the flavour of Terrence Malick's work in this, if not entirely the quality. Very few things are comparable with Badlands. I mean, I think Terrence Malick is, you know, for me, he's everything that Stanley Kubrick wasn't. He's a great visionary, but he also had some kind of substance. But I think there are interesting things in Undertow. It plays like a sort of, like a lazy, hot summer afternoon. Occasionally you feel yourself nodding slightly and it's slightly dreamlike. But I don't say that as a bad thing. I mean, it has as I said, a dreamlike fairy tale, parable-like quality. It has a very interesting score by Philip Glass, which is that kind of, you know, spiraling, circling kind of thing, and a very interesting soundscape. It's definitely it's a movie of moments rather than of linear narrative, but there's a lot to recommend. And Jamie Bell is really good because it's very hard to do that Georgia accent. I mean,
he said he just hung out at Walmart a lot,
yeah,
and just listened to people.
That's right. He said that was how he researched it. And obviously that's the way to do it. He just went and talked to them. And I mean, I'm not American. The question would be whether or not an American audience could hear it. But apparently Americans who have seen it have thought he's doing absolutely fine. Other thing it's worth mentioning this week is this weird thing, Bombón El Perro, which is a movie set, it's a Patagonian movie about a 52-year-old guy called Juan Villegas, who's played by a guy who really is a 52-year-old guy called Juan Villegas, and he's a garage mechanic, but he's made redundant, and he doesn't know what to do, so he attempts to sell some knives, and then he gives somebody a lift, And they go back to their house and they say, hey, you've been really nice to me. Would you like this thoroughbred Argentinian doggo, which is apparently the only breed that is exclusive to Argentina? If you know anything about dog rearing, which I don't at all, it's this peculiar breed of dog, which is apparently bred for hunting and for, you know, for fighting and for being sort of quite vicious. But it's a lovely sort of well-behaved dog. And the rest of the movie just follows this guy going around in his truck with his dog going into competitions. And you keep thinking it's going to turn into Amores Perros. You keep thinking it's going to be dog fighting and horror and nastiness. But in fact, it is much, much closer in tone to Best in Show, which I absolutely love, the Spinal Tap movie about dog competitions. And it's quirky and strange and weird. And it is one of the very few movies I've ever seen in which the conjoining of two dogs constitutes a genuinely happy ending. And, you know, it's whimsical to the point of absolute insubstantiality. But on the other hand, it's the best Argentinian thoroughbred dog movie of the year.
Can't beat that. It's a small category.
It is.
I'll be surprised if there's any rivals for that much sought-after post.
Nuns on the Run was the best transvestite anti-clerical comedy of the year, apparently, according to one reviewer.
Movie of the week?
Well, Batman Begins. I mean, go see it, but like I said, 10 and upwards. It's not for younger kids.
And you'll be at Wimbledon next Friday.
Will I?
Yes, you
will.
Oh, great. That's where our films come from next week. Full Wimbledon coverage starts Monday, 12:30. See you then. Have a great weekend.